I'm Deanne Lagerquist, and I'm here from St. Olaf College. And what we've been doing this week is looking at a series of five American religious women. The title under which we're doing this is Blessed Are They Who Have Faith, or actually the quotation from Luke is Blessed Are They Who Hear the Word of God and Keep It. And so we're looking at these five women whose lives are, for us, earthen vessels, and who bring in that vessel the treasure of their faith. And it seems to me they also provide us with some guidance about how we, whether we're women or men, or different from different traditions, or in different communities, and certainly in different times, live out our faith. Consequently, I've been asking people, as we consider each of these women, to think of their answer to three questions. What do you find admirable about this woman? What do you find troublesome about the woman? Because most of our models aren't perfect models. We don't do everything the way that they do it. I've sometimes said about, I don't know a great deal about my great-grandmother who lived in the Red River Valley of Minnesota. But the family stories are things that are appealing to me, except that she was a farmer and had 11 children. And those two pieces I don't want. But other parts of who she was are real important to me. So what do you find admirable? What do you find troublesome? And what would you like to emulate? What are the things about this woman that you can appropriate into your own life? So far, we've looked at three women, and I've just noted their names and the dates of their life up there for a bit of a review. Because part of the reason, part of what I hope will be helpful about looking at Dorothy Day today, since she's probably a familiar character, is to see her along with these other women. The first was Lucretia Mott, who was a Quaker preacher, and I described her as a practical prophet or a householder, someone whose prophetic voice was intimately linked with her community, her family. We spoke on Wednesday a little bit in Vespers and in Matins about the Seneca Falls Women's Rights Convention. Well, James Mott moderated those meetings. That's about the most noise he ever makes, but he was always there. So a practical prophet, a woman who was connected to her community, not a John the Baptist kind of prophet, but a different kind of prophet, or a householder, one who took the whole world as her household and tried to put it in some kind of order. Then we looked at Amanda Berry Smith, a holiness preacher. I described her with her own vocabulary as an evangelist, a messenger of good news. Her confidence came more from her deep felt assurance that the Holy Spirit had called her, so that she was able to do things that were radical, to be a woman who was preaching in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, to be a black woman who preached to white people, to go to England, to India, and to Sierra Leone and Liberia as a missionary. And then on Wednesday we looked at Vida Scudder, who was, I decided, primarily a teacher in all the areas of her life. She was a teacher by profession. She was a professor of English at Wellesley College. She was also active in the labor movement, in the college settlement house movement, in socialist circles, and as a prayer, a woman devoted to intercessory prayer, bringing these things together and trying to teach those lessons across boundaries. Each one of these women found life within her church, or within her denomination. But each has also been other than the perfect example of a member of that denomination. And for me, that's one of the things that I find very inspiring, that they've been willing to stay inside even when they don't fit exactly. To say, this is where I live, this is what has given me life, and here's where I think we can grow, much as perhaps we're able to do in our families. the women have not only survived in those places, they have recreated the places that they have been. I think in the case of Lucretia Mott, we see that as she pushed the friends in the early part of the 19th century to have cooperation outside of the society, in her resistance to the narrowness of the Society of Friends, and there are some specific examples of that, particularly when people married out of meeting, and that you were supposed to be shunned, in that we think of the Quakers now as being, you know, real open to everybody, but in the early part of the 19th century there was this narrowing, and Lucretia Mott really resisted that. As I mentioned just a few seconds ago, Amanda Berry Smith as a woman preaching in the African Methodist Episcopal Church and as a black person preaching to white people. We see it in Vita Scudder's concern for the labor movement, socialism, and as a practicer of intercessory prayer. All of those are examples, if we go back to the theme of the summer, of embracing contraries, holding together things that may seem, at first glance, incompatible. How can you be a member of the Socialist Party and be devoted to intercessory prayer? These don't seem to click. How can you be an academic and involved in the Settlement House movement? The cost is not low, and in Vita Scudder's case, we saw that in the early part of the 1900s, she suffered a nervous breakdown as a consequence of doing so many things. But at the same time, she did try and bring those things together, and as she got older, she got better at it. And I think that bringing those contraries together is really one of the exciting and vital characteristics of our Christianity. I'm always trying to get my students to see, because at St. Olaf we get a lot of students who are churched, at least nominally, and usually a little more than nominally, who don't necessarily want to have to take a religion class because they think they know it all. And I'm trying often to get them to see that things aren't what they seem to be. They're always becoming something else, and that the wonder of Christianity is this sort of irony. Jesus is dead, but Jesus is alive. We're sinners, but we're saints. And I was so pleased when Walt kind of made this point in the Bible study this morning, because it was already written down in my notebook, that we're saved by God's grace alone, but we are also responsible for being little Christs. They don't seem to go together, and yet they are together. We take them both, and we go on and on. Well, today we look at a woman who is in many ways the personification of the summer's theme, I think, of embracing contraries and treasure in an earthen vessel, Dorothy Day. Of the five that women in this series, she's probably the one that most of you are likely to know about. At least you've heard her name, if you haven't already read some of her stuff. But it may be that looking at her along with these other women will give us some new insights. Let me just point to some resources. If you don't know about Dorothy Day, and you're looking to find some things out. The two excerpts that we'll read are from these books, The Long Loneliness, which is her second autobiography. The first was From Union Square to Rome. And I'll say a little bit more about The Long Loneliness as we go on. The second set, actually in your pink sheets, it's the first. The first two selections are from this, By Little and By Little. And this is over in the bookstore. It's a compilation of Dorothy Day's writings put together by Robert Ellsberg, who was an editor of the Catholic Worker for late in Dorothy Day's life. And that draws from a variety of different sources arranged thematically. The introductions to both of these books are really good. This one is by Daniel Berrigan, who was very influenced by Dorothy Day. It's written shortly after her death, and then Robert Ellsberg's is also a very good introduction. Two other resources, secondary sources, that I think are real useful. Miller's biography, Dorothy Day, you may have seen, it's a big, thick book with a brown cover and a picture of her on the cover, is very good. It was written, it's not an authorized biography, but it was written with Dorothy's cooperation. And she knew that Miller was working on a biography. It was stunning in many ways when it came out because it tells a lot of things about Dorothy Day's early life that had been, unspoken. She was very reticent about her youth, and if you don't know about that, I'll say some more about it later. You can see why she was reticent about it. And Miller puts all of that stuff out in the light. The second book that I recommend very highly is by Mel Peel. It's called Breaking Bread, and it's really a story of the Catholic worker movement, but with important sections on Dorothy Day. Mel Peel also has been up at Holden Village, and I checked this morning, he has 3 tapes in the library on the Catholic worker movement and Dorothy Day. And I was sort of tempted just to play one of them for you because Mel is really an expert. In contrast to some of the other figures we've looked at, there is a ton of information about Dorothy Day. All the writing that she did over 50 years in the Catholic Worker, all the things that people wrote about her while she was alive. There's, for example, a wonderful New Yorker profile of Dorothy Day in 1952. It's just by someone named McDonald. It's just wonderful. So there's always plenty of stuff about her to read. Obituary is usually not a very good source for that sort of thing, but in the case of Dorothy Day, there is one obituary by David O'Brien that I think comes close to one of the reasons we should pay attention to her. He said that she was the most significant, interesting, and influential person in the history of American Catholicism. Now, I'm almost nervous about most, but she's right up there. We'll stop the tape for just a minute and give you a chance to read through these excerpts. You should have 2 pages. The ones, Small Things and Grumblers, are from the worker movement. The other 2 parts are from The Long Loneliness. The ones on the back of Grumblers are about the period of time when she's becoming a Catholic. And I'll just give you as much time as it takes you to read those, and then we'll start again. As we go along, let me also say about these resources that Peel's book, Breaking Bread, there are copies of that in the bookstore. And he's a friend of mine, so I encourage you especially to buy his book. Dorothy Day, let's put her chronologically in context with some of the people we've looked at earlier this week. She's born in 1897. It's about a century after Mott was born, but only 20 years after Mott died. It's during the time that Amanda Berry Smith has returned to the United States. I can't quite place whether she's in Chicago still or has moved to Florida. It's a decade and a half into Scudder's teaching career. One of Scudder's childhood memories, one of her first childhood memories, was hearing that Lincoln had been shot. Day was living with her family as a young child in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, of the great San Francisco earthquake in the early 1900s. So if that helps for you to figure out where she is in our century, that's when she was a child. Like these other women, not quite as much as Vida Scudder, but remarkably so nonetheless. Dorothy Day was very long-lived. She lived to be 83 years old, dying only in 1980, less than a decade ago, and you may remember that. Her life falls into stages along a pilgrimage. She used the title On Pilgrimage for her column, her ongoing column, in The Long Loneliness, in the Catholic Worker publication. And I think that the image is a very good one for understanding her life. And I mentioned that on Wednesday, that I tend to see this kind of pattern in these women's religious development, that it's a journey, it's a pilgrimage, and in the cases of Scudder and Day, particularly, they use that image Scott are using on journey and day on pilgrimage. The two primary stages we see in Day's life, and she cultivated this impression. It's the period up to 1927 when she was baptized a Catholic. It was a, as you read here, provisional kind of baptism because she had been baptized in the Anglican Church. And then the period after that, particularly after the early 1930s, once she met Peter Morin and started the Catholic Worker Movement. Interestingly, however, in her autobiography, she gives us three stages instead of two. The first is a time of searching. The middle period she calls natural happiness. And it's in the middle of natural happiness that we get the selection that I gave you about Forrester and her baptism. It's real interesting to me that that doesn't come. She doesn't start a new section right there. And that's one of, I've done some work on her autobiography together with Vita Scudder's. And that's one of the ways I make the argument that these are not turning points, they're forks in the road. And she's still going always in the same direction, but she's not turning around. The early part of her life, she came from a kind of interesting American family. And this makes her unusual in Catholicism in that time period. Early part of this century, late part of the last century, American Catholicism was perceived generally as being an immigrant religion. It was a religion of immigrants, particularly Irish. And by coming into this century, Eastern Europeans, Poles, Czechoslovakians, people like that. It was not, despite the fact that the first Catholics in North America, in Maryland, were aristocratic, the Calvert family, for the most part, Lord Baltimore, by this time, everyone thought of Catholics as sort of laborers, working class, non-English speakers, dirty, urban, and there was a lot of nativism. And nativism, as in natives are good, white, native-born people are good, and people who aren't born here, who don't speak the language, are terrible. The no Irish need apply, that phenomenon. So Day coming out of a family that it's hard, kind of hard to trace the roots back. They've been in the U.S. pretty long. Her father is probably from around Tennessee somewhere. He was a sports writer, kind of itinerant. She was born in Brooklyn. As I mentioned, they lived for a while in the Bay Area, then back to Chicago where a lot of her growing up years, formative years, were spent. There are several children in the family. She had two brothers near her in age, a sister near her in age, and then a younger brother who was born when she was an adolescent. The family life was not religious, but in her autobiography, she identifies episodes of religious and fascination in a way. The next door neighbors in Oakland were Methodists, and she remembers that. And of course her autobiography, I should say this about her autobiography, it's in the tradition of Augustine's Confessions. The purpose of her autobiography was to tell of God's bringing her to, she would say, to himself, which is very traditional vocabulary, to himself. And that's what Augustine's Confessions are about. Augustine's Confessions are cast as a prayer. The Long Loneliness is not cast as a prayer, but aside from that, it's very, very similar. Scudder's autobiography, she says, is to put the story of her, to loose the story of her soul. So there's a kind of similarity, but Day's is even more focused on this purpose. So it's not surprising that she would highlight the fact there were these Methodists who lived near her. When she was a child in Chicago, she was active intermittently in Episcopal Church. And she tells about reading the Psalms. She tells about reading the Bible, being attracted to the ritual. But she also says she looked for Christians and they were just like everybody else. At the same time, she was reading Upton Sinclair, some of the labor novelists, and in her autobiography she tells us about taking her little brother in his carriage and walking out on the west side, out near the stockyards and the packing houses, and being fascinated by the poor. She won a scholarship, a Hearst scholarship, to go to the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. She went there for 2 years, and I don't like to talk about this period of her life to my college students because she didn't go to class very much. She, except in a way, I kind of want to talk to today's college students about it, because she did what she needed to learn, and she wasn't constrained about what grade am I going to get. She wanted to learn. She was very poor, and she, her autobiography is clear about how poor she was and how she would work in families where she could get room and board for taking care of the children or doing housework, and how cold she was. And she'd sit in her room in the blankets and just read all day because it was too cold to go to class and she hadn't had enough to eat. She also became interested in socialism in this time period. Libby, do you want to ask a question?
No.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you can, of course, ask a question anytime you want. Okay, so that's one period of her life, and I think when she goes to University of Illinois, it's the beginning of the period that we might call her radical period, in the sense of being a social radical. I talked about Scudder being during the period of the social gospel movement. Outside of the church, there was a kind of social radicalism in the labor movement, the growth of the Socialist Party. All that stuff you see in Reds was going on in this time period. Her family then moved to New York City, and she followed them but did not live with them because she wanted to work as a journalist, as her two brothers did, as her father did. And her father didn't think this was a good idea for a woman to be a journalist, so she didn't live at home. And her relationship with her father was not good. First, he didn't like that she was radical, and then he really didn't like that she was religious. So that wasn't a good relationship. She maintained contact throughout her life with her mother, especially with her sister, Della, and with her younger brother, John. Those were the family relationships that continued. In New York, she did hang out with all those people in Reds. John Reed, Eugene O'Neill, and this is something, of course, that does appeal to college students. They just think this is really fascinating. The story was that she could drink Eugene O'Neill under the table. I think she must have been pouring her drinks down the floor or something. When you hear about how much he drank, I can't imagine anyone could drink him under the table. She was a good friend of Eugene O'Neill's. And others in that circle, Mike Gold, she worked for the Liberator, she worked for the Masses, she worked for the Call, all these social critical publications. One of the first articles she did for them was called The One Woman Hunger Squad. And she tried to live on the amount of money that whatever that department was called in those days, Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, or whatever it was called, said that you should be able to live on. And she told about what she had to eat and how that felt, and the neighborhood that she lived in, particularly among Jewish immigrants at that time.
Deanne, are we late 20s, early 30s at this point?
Teens,
yeah.
Yeah. She was briefly involved in the suffragist movement, but not intimately. She kind of went along, and that was her first experience of being in prison. She went with her friend Peggy Baird to Washington to one of the suffrage demonstrations and was arrested, and they went on a hunger strike. And it's a wonderful passage in The Long Loneliness about that hunger strike and how it gave her a sense of connection with other people. Also, of course, in tune with the purpose of that book, she tells how she asked for a Bible, and she read the Bible at that time. Then we come to the time that in The Long Loneliness we don't know a lot about. During the First World War, she and her sister were in nursing school, probationer nurses. Of course, nursing school was very different in those days than it is now. Mostly what it meant was she was on the floor working. There she contracted a relationship with a man about whom she felt very strongly. She became pregnant and had an abortion because she thought that was how she would be able to keep this relationship going. It didn't work. He still left. Then she also, in this period, was married very briefly. And again, there's not much known about that, except that this man had a history of short-term marriages. And she never said a word, either about her abortion or about that marriage in print. That's stuff that we get from Peel and from Miller. But I think it's reliable information. I mean, it's not made up, and neither of them are out to smear Dorothy Day. What they're out to do more, I think, is to remind us that this is a woman who was not an airhead in her spirituality. She's not ungrounded, and she's not unaware of what life was really like. There is kind of a tendency in the popular presentation of Dorothy Day to make her into a saint. And in fact, there was a special issue of Cross Current some years ago that pictures and makes an icon picture of Dorothy Day, like we see of saints. And I'm not sure that's really helpful at all. So I give you that information about her not to say, oh, look, sort of like all the stuff that's come out about Kennedy that makes us want to throw up on our childhood scrapbooks of Kennedy's assassination. But to say, here's a real woman who was struggling and trying to find a way to be in the world that was just, that was full, and was life-giving. She moved around a little bit, living in Chicago, living in New Orleans. She wrote an autobiographical novel called The 11th Virgin. It's not in print. In the second half of her life, she repudiated it. I've never read it. It's not, there aren't a lot of copies around. But one of the important things that The 11th Virgin did for her is that she got money from it for the film rights. No one ever made a movie of it. I think the people in Hollywood loved the title, and so they bought the film rights. With that money, Dorothy Day bought a little piece of property on the beach in Staten Island. And now we come to the period that she describes in The Long Loneliness as natural happiness. And that's what you read about in these sections here. Natural happiness begins with the words, something like, I contracted a common law marriage with a man named Forrester. He was an anarchist, British background, a biologist by training. And I gave you this quotation in part because it's so tender. Sort of the same reason I tell you these things about her that we don't usually hear. Dorothy Day didn't live an ascetic life because she didn't love life. She lived it because she did love life. And she loved people. And I think especially in this section, and as she describes her relationship with Forrester, we can feel that. I loved him in every way, as a wife, as a mother even. I loved him for all he knew and pitied him for all he didn't know. I loved him for the odds and ends I had to fish out of his sweater pockets, and for the sand and the shells he brought in with his fishing. I loved his lean, cold body as he got into bed smelling of the sea, and I loved his integrity and stubborn pride. I mean, doesn't it give you shivers? It's just, oh, so wonderful. And yet, at the same time, she's growing away from that. And we find Dorothy Day is an interesting figure for my title, Blessed Are They Who Have Faith, which is Jesus' response when people call out to him, blessed is the woman whose womb gave you birth and whose breasts gave you suck? And he says, no, blessed are they who have faith. Because in a way, it's becoming a mother that pushes Dorothy Day into the church. It's because of Tamar, her child, hers and Forrester's child, that she finally becomes a Catholic. The whole time she was carrying Tamar, she was taking catechism lessons from this old nun who took her through the Baltimore Catechism. And if you think Luther's small catechism is dull, which I hope you don't, the Baltimore Catechism is infinitely more boring. It's thick and it's... Oh. And that was the instruction that she was getting. And you can see a little bit of that in the longer excerpt in this page where she talks about the church, that she saw both the bad and the good in the church. Dorothy had Tamar baptized. There was still another interlude before she herself was baptized. She knew it was going to cost her. She says, it cost her Forrester. It cost her Forrester for two reasons. It cost her Forrester because he would have nothing to do with religion and the church. So because of his integrity and stubborn pride. It also cost her Forrester because the church in the 1920s did not look generously on common law marriages. And there was no way that Dorothy would have been accepted into the church if she continued to live with Forrester without being married. And there was no way he was going to get married in the church any more than he would get married by the state. So that's one thing that she lost. The other thing that for about a little less than a decade she was afraid she had lost was the radical movement. Many of her friends who had been, socialists and pacifists and anti-conscription league didn't know what she was doing. They didn't understand the mystery of it. The church, although the church was composed primarily in the United States of immigrants, the hierarchy was not understood to be on the side of the poor. In the late 20th century, we often think of liberation theology, the church is on the side of the poor, the Catholics have all of this social consciousness. O'Brien's obituary is saying part of the reason for that is Dorothy Day. That Dorothy Day's example from about 1930 to 1980, those 50 years changed the American Catholic Church. Okay. Day didn't know very many lay Catholics. She didn't fall in love with the people of the church. You might say she fell in love with the God she saw through the church, with what she read in the New Testament. And so for a few years, and she traveled during this time period, she lived in Hollywood for a while. She was supposed to be writing screenplays. They never gave her much to do. She went and lived in Mexico for a while, continued to write both for the socialist press and increasingly for the Catholic press, particularly the Jesuit publication America and another liberal Catholic publication, The Commonweal. She went to Mass. She was very faithful in that way, but she didn't know many Catholics. And I think it must have been an awfully sad and lonely time for her. Struggling with the contrariness, loving both the form and the mystery of the church, but not really seeing those lived out. Okay. Now I'm doing what so many scholars do. We spend all this time in the beginning of Day's life, and then we get to the Catholic movement, and then it was the movement. She went back to New York City. She was writing. She's supporting herself as pretty much a freelance author. And that's what she was doing. She's living with her brother and his wife. And, of course, Tamar is with her and growing. She never says why she named that baby Tamar. And I've always wondered about that. It's not, how many Tamars do you really know? It's not they're more than Bathsheba's, but not many. She went to Washington, D.C. in 1932 to cover a hunger strike. Of course, by now it's the Depression. And that was a point of transition again. Or maybe it's a point where, you know, you come in paths and they come apart and then they come back together. It may be that this is where they start to come back together for Dorothy. And she tells us she went into the a shrine there and prayed about how isolated she felt. That before she had been with the people, with the poor, and now she was with God, but she wasn't with the poor. She wasn't doing anything for them. She got home, and there was Peter Morin. Peter Morin, interesting character. He was a French peasant from an enormous family. He was, for a while, working with the Christian Brothers in education. He'd ridden the rails all over Canada and the United States. Later, Day tells stories about how Peter would be sent off to talk at some church, and the people would call up and say, he hasn't come. There's this old bum sitting on our front step. But where is this guy? They said, that's Peter. It was a man who lived ideas. And immediately, he'd been told by people he'd met in New York that you should talk to Dorothy Day. She has the same kind of ideas you do. But what he began to do was teach her. He thought her education was not very good. She didn't know the right things. And at first, he kind of thought she was going to be Catherine of Siena, who was a mystic and a reformer of the church in Italy in the Middle Ages. He had to back off of that. He discovered she wasn't Catherine of Siena, but she was Dorothy Day. Very strong-willed, willing to learn, but also going to do what she thought needed to be done. The first thing they did together was start a newspaper called The Catholic Worker. The first issue came out on May Day. It was an effort to bring together the social teachings of the church, which were there, encyclicals from the Pope about the living wage, about social justice, to bring those out and apply them, not just to let them sit in books and in libraries. Like John Ryan, sometimes called Father New Deal, or something like that, was real active in the New Deal, had also found those encyclicals when he was reading in seminary. The stuff was there, just wasn't being applied. The Catholic Worker movement had three primary parts. The newspaper, called The Catholic Worker, it still comes out, costs a penny, always costs a penny. Houses of hospitality, which spring up and disappear and spring up. The whole movement is a movement. Reminds me of the early church. Real fluid, real organic. Houses of hospitality began, as you read in the postscript, because we were sitting there talking and people moved in on us. We were sitting there talking when lines of people began to form saying, we need bread. And so that's what they did, particularly in the area of New York called the Battery and the Bowery. People were hungry and they gave them food and they gave them coffee and gave them clothes when they had it and sometimes did really extraordinary things. Ellsberg, in his introduction to By Little and By Little, says one of the contradictions or the contraries in Dorothy Day is her sense that every act of charity must be extravagant in some way. And so he tells the story about one day someone gave a diamond ring to the Catholic Worker, and everyone thought, great, we're going to sell this ring. We'll get a lot of money. And she gave it to some old street woman and said, not only the rich deserve to have things that are beautiful. She can sell it if she wants to, but she can wear it if she wants to. It kind of reminds me of the story about the ointment. So the houses that provided hospitality, food, sometimes a place to sleep, and also a place of conversation, which was one of Peter's big things, is you talk about things and you indoctrinate and teach principles and get people to think about what needs to be done and then to do it. The other place he wanted to do it was in farm schools. He wanted to have farms out in the country that would be like universities. This was the part of the movement that was the least successful. They kept getting people who wanted to think but not work, eat but not farm. And those didn't work, and they had several times to withdraw from a site because people would take over. Families would come out and decide, well, this is our place, and all these derelicts are bothering us. You know, don't bring them out here. So that was the most difficult part of the movement. Those three things, however, go on. The movement spread organically. Houses spring up. They go down. Dorothy traveled a lot, usually on the bus. She had a real close contact with people. And as the years went by, we began to see some more contraries. On the one hand, a very conservative piety. Dorothy Day went to daily mass. She said the rosary. She's frequently quoted as saying, if her bishop told her to close down, she would do so. At the same time, and you know, that's where the legend comes. You know, Dorothy was very obedient. At the same time, she was very clever, you know, and it never came to the point where the bishop had to tell her to close down. But she opposed. There was a strike of grave diggers against the archdiocese in New York, and she supported the grave diggers in them. So it's not that she had no courage. But she was also as smart as a serpent, as well as innocent as a dove. A conservative piety with a very radical social view. Practical charity, but speaking about justice. One of her last kind of public demonstrations was with the United Farm Workers and Cesar Chavez. But in the 50s, she was imprisoned several times for not obeying civil, what were those called? Remember when you have to go down and what are they called? Civil defense drills. She wouldn't go inside because she was a pacifist and she didn't think you should have war. You could see this sort of in the fluctuation of the circulation of a Catholic worker, how what she's doing is popular or unpopular. What is her significance? There's some very direct significance on particularly people in the late 60s and early 70s, like the Berrigans. I should have written his name down. The guy who's the president of Social Democrats of America, Tom Harrington. People like that who passed through the Catholic worker. It survives entirely on volunteer labor, volunteer contributions. They don't have any kind of a fundraising campaign. They don't want it. They're not incorporated. Their gifts are not tax deductible. And people have been very influenced by that and gone on to do other kinds of things. I think that's really important. Not only the work that goes on in the Catholic worker, but what people who have been at the Catholic worker have done. Then secondly, a more indirect influence on the social program of Roman Catholicism. And I think the social program of a lot of American Christianity has been influenced by the example of Dorothy Day and the Catholic worker. Sometimes it gives us courage to do the small thing. And that's one of the things that's really remarkable, I think, and about Dorothy Day. She's not afraid to do the small thing as well as the big thing, which is, of course, why Ellsberg gives us this title, By Little and By Little, which is one of her favorite phrases. Well, I've gone on quite long, and let me stop and give you a chance to respond to what I've said or what you already know about Dorothy Day, and particularly in the framework of those three questions, what do you find admirable, what do you find troublesome, and what would you like to emulate?
I don't quite understand how she could switch to the church. I mean, I don't quite get whether she felt like she should do it, you know, and there's a lot of talk in our day about doing things freely rather than doing things out of guilt or some sort of compulsion to do the right thing, you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's a wonderful piece in The Long Loneliness where, in which she writes about having Tamar baptized. And she said she wanted to do this for her child so that Tamar wouldn't be adrift like she had been adrift so long. So I think in part it was her ability to see a sort of mysterious truth about the church. And also I think it was for her an anchor.
You know, had she joined another church, she could have kept her relationship.
She doesn't ever really address that, except I do think she'd been, it wasn't a sudden decision for her. And she'd had for a number of years, occasionally and sometimes regularly, been drawn in to Catholic parishes and gone to Mass there. I think the mystery. It's really important. She's a mystic as well as a practical woman. And it's, there's a sense of wonder that was attractive to her that in a way that a Congregationalist church never would have been. And she could see the resources. She was also attracted, I think, in the same way that Vida Scudder was. Both of them are very explicit about this. The church across time. It's not just us now, but it's way back. And they both write about people like Catherine of Siena was important to both of them, St. Francis of Assisi, Teresa of Avila. So they find in the saints their own models. I think that's part of it.
Did she ever reconnect with her old liberal friend?
Yeah, and Ellsberg, I think it's Berrigan who writes about that, how she was, for many years, very fierce about that. He seems to think there was a sort of bitterness that she'd had to give up Forrester. And so for a long time, she didn't talk at all to Philip Berrigan after he married. But late in her life, Daniel Berrigan says, she started to ask about him. And she wanted to hear about his children. And she said she started to visit Forrester when he was old and sick. So there is a kind of mellowing at the end. And the tag that I would put on Dorothy Day, you know, the others, evangelist, teacher, practical prophet, ironically with Dorothy Day, I always come back to that she's a mother. And she's the mother of that movement. It's very... In a sort of stereotypical way that she mothered that movement. It's not programmatic. She's not the CEO. She's the mother of the movement. And I do that in part, as I mentioned before, because she does describe herself, and you see it in the postscript. I found myself a barren woman, the joyful mother of children. It is not always easy to be joyful, to keep in mind the duty of delight. She uses that phrase about herself three times. And sometimes it's about Tamar, but mostly it's about the movement. And I would connect that with that mellowing at the end, that those are her family, and she does finally go back to them.
I was thinking also in terms of, as the Catholic worker movement started, which was very politically liberal, if she connected again with some of those folks that...
Some, especially Mike Gold, and in by little... By little and by little is her remarks about Mike Gold when he died. And she calls him, she says he was her oldest friend. Yeah. So those who could at least allow her religiousness she did connect with them.